The title of our panel here is in the form of a question. Is there genocide in the Sudan? And I chose, instead of saying genocide in the Sudan, asserting that there was genocide in the Sudan, what I try to do is to make sure that I leave the issue open. The question form leaves the issue open so that each one of us provides his or her own definition. You know, when I was an undergraduate, I took philosophy. And one of the things I was taught was that when you are engaged in an argument, in a debate or in a discussion, you should define your terms. First define the terms so that you both, or whoever is engaged in this debate or argument, understands that the terms on which you agree are clearer to both parties. I think that was a vain hope. And as a first year undergraduate, I did rather well. By the second term, by the second year, I did very badly. Because by temperament, I had to discover later, or maybe I was rationalizing, but I had to discover later that the notion that if you define your terms, then the issues on which you disagree will become clearer and the possibilities of agreement become more likely, was really delusion. And especially in our age now, where truth has become more, I mean, where we are more skeptical, and the very notion of having one final truth on which people can agree has become even more unlikely. You know, so by the second time, this was empty.
You don't need a facilitator, and you're fine by yourself.
There should have been one here, a moderator, someone to take questions and when I'm finished.
Okay.
So by the second year, I took philosophy again. I found that these words, these definitions, in fact, led to mere word spinning. I'm a practical person, and applying it in my discussions, my conversations within my community with fellow students, really never seemed to lead to any practical agreements. Agreements always remained. And it's only later that I discovered that words carry their own loads. They acquire so many, it's not only the what they denote, the connotations, what they pick up, that words are loaded, no matter how you define them, how you try to clarify them. So the form of raising the issue here in the question form seems to me fairer. Not honor to whoever is hearing you, but it also does justice to whoever is against whom the acts of genocide are being alleged. In the case of the Sudan, of course, it's the Sudan government. But is it the Sudan government? Is it only the Sudan government in this particular situation that may be committing acts of genocide in the Sudan? Or are the other parties, like the opposition group, the warlords, the militias, who may not be under the control of the government, are they also involved in these acts of genocide? So I leave the question open. And also by training, I'm not a lawyer, I'm not a political scientist. And given the terrible acts that are happening in country and the seeming indifference of the international community, What I'm trying to do is present to you the specific events and also to tell you why I think those events are happening to particular groups of people. That's the approach I'm taking. I'm not going to get bogged down with internationally accepted definitions of genocide. I'll give you a set of events. And the best way I can do that is to take you through a series of happenings, things that happened in the modern history of the Sudan, which you may or may not regard as acts of genocide. The Sudan is a very large country, the largest country in Africa, with a population of nearly 36, larger than the population of Canada, of 36 million people. By population, by culture, language, and religion, is a very diverse country, probably one of the most diverse in the world. There are about 150 languages spoken there, not dialects, languages spoken there. But the official language of government, of education, in the Sudan is, of course, Arabic. Arabic being the language spoken by the most dominant single group in the country. And that is people in the north who claim Arab origin. The 1956 census figures in the Sudan broke the population of the Sudan down into about 1/3 of the population, which claimed Arab origin. In the context of the Sudan, of course, this brings in the racial dimension, but I'll deal with that later. The claim Arab origin by culture, by language, and of course by religion. These are the three pillars of domination in the Sudan. Claim to a particular racial origin, Arabic, Arab, religion, Islam, and then language. The other 2/3 of the population are people of African origin. About 67% of the population is of African origin. So by ethnicity, the African element is the majority element in the country. In purely ethnic terms, by religion, 75% of the population of the Sudan is Muslim. So you have two sets of majorities here. There's an ethnic majority, and there's a religious majority. And because of its dominance, for a variety of reasons, some of which we can discuss later when you raise questions, because of its dominance, it's this small group, and even a smaller group within this. I think I have a map of the Sudan somewhere. I don't know if I can find it. We don't have... So this small group and a smaller group within this small group has set the tone, has defined the identity of the Sudan. The Sudan as an Arab country, the Sudan as an Islamic country, And the Sudan as a country in which Arabic is the language. And as I indicated earlier, because of the diversity of its population by ethnicity and so on, various governments in the country have tried to impose a homogeneity on a country that is heterogeneous by religion, by language, by culture, and by ethnicity. So you already have seeds of conflict sown there, where one a smaller elite group within a minority group by ethnicity, as self-defined really, is trying to impose homogeneity of religion, of language, and so on a huge country, the largest country in Africa, 1 million square miles, 1 million square miles of it. And where I come from, which is the third of the country, southern third of the country, bordering Uganda and Kenya, and Congo, Ethiopia, there's an even more diversity, because what happens in the case of the northern part of the country, Islam and the Arabic language have imposed a certain degree of homogeneity which is absent in the south. Now, when I say ethnicity, we have to be very careful. For those of you who know what Arabs, you know, they are a Semitic people, just like the Jewish people. So, by color, you know, they come in a variety of hues. You know, some very light, some even blonde. But you won't find that in the Sudan. And when I say Arabs in the Sudan, anybody says Arab in the context of the Sudan, they're really talking, you know, the African American, for example, would probably be lighter than, you know, by complexion than the average Northern Sudanese. So where does this race element come in the context of the Sudan? Where's the racial element? That takes us into discussions of a set of attitudes, a frame of mind. You know, it becomes how matters of self-definition, arbitrary, you know, which leads us into the conclusion that when you say race, really, this a social construct. You know, you self-define yourself, define yourself into some group to which, by complexion, you may not even belong. So that the Arab in the Sudan is Arab simply because he or she feels that she's Arab. She claims Arab identity because she's Muslim, claims Arab identity because they speak Arabic. And in this process, what happens is that those who define themselves in this way have to invent ancestry. And in the among the ruling houses, the mostly religious, sectarian religious Islamic groups, you validate your definition, self-definition, by tracing your origins to Arabia. And if necessary, to the family of the Prophet Muhammad. So you can see, you know, the whole thing is arbitrary. Who is Arab and who is not Arab is just how you feel. If you feel that, you know, it's more prestigious to be regarded, to define yourself as Arab, that definition and how you identify may help you advance. It's all connected with power, with privilege. the definition, if you are Arab, you speak Arabic, you are Muslim, then belonging to this particular elite group, certain advantages accrue to belonging to that particular group to which you, into which you have self-defined yourself. That's the background to the events that have been happening in Sudan. It's not only this particular group that arbitrarily self-defines itself, but the whole country. Before 1821, when the ruler of Egypt, someone called Muhammad Ali, invaded the Sudan for a variety of reasons, some of which I mentioned yesterday for those of you who were there, and I don't intend to get into them now. The name Sudan simply meant land of the blacks, a definition that was imposed by the first foreign explorers, foreign people they discovered. And the historical land of the blacks, the Sudan, Bilad al-Sudan in Arabic, actually stretched all the way from the Horn, east to west, and would include countries like Nigeria now, that definition. So by 1821, it began more and more to be confined to the country that became the called the Anglo-Egyptian Sudan. The Sudan became limited to this particular area, the geographical area, which is now the modern Republic of the Sudan within its 1 million square miles. But the term Sudan simply meant the first foreign explorers or found a darker people than they had encountered before, and they were Arab. So Sud in Arabic means black. And because taking you back again to the definition, self-definition, Arab, I'm Arab, I'm African, arbitrary self-definitions. Because of Africa's history of being regarded as a continent of inferior people, no one wanted to identify with Africa. It explains why a group of people who may not look terribly different by complexion from me decided that they were better off identifying themselves with the Arab world than with this much humiliated continent. No one wants to associate with a loser. And Africa as a whole was, Africa south of the Sahara was perceived as a land inhabited by subhumans or inferior people. And that sense of feeling that to identify with Africa is to somehow come down a notch in self-esteem has played and continues to play a very big role in the problems that face the Sudan as a modern nation state. So that the whole, not just this small group, but the whole country is what someone has called, described as emergent community. An emergent community can only be held together by consensus, by common agreement. You unite on the basis of those things which unite you and avoid those things which divide you. And when you impose homogeneity, artificially impose artificial homogeneity, of course you have the kind of conflict here. And because the South is predominantly inhabited by people who are neither Muslim nor had any claim to Arabism, did not speak Arabic and so on, you know, and was not in fact as homogeneous, relatively more homogeneous, less homogeneous than the Northern Sudan. The British came and closed it off, closed the southern part of the country off, and one or two areas in the Northern Sudan inhabited by the Nuba, people called the Nuba, not Nubians. The Nubians are people, you know, along the Nile, the Halfa area, for those of you who know the geography of the Nile Valley, just south of Egypt, you know, south of Aswan. Those people are called Nubians. They have been Arabized, they have been Islamized, they speak Arabic, but they also speak the indigenous languages. They look lighter than a lot of people who call themselves, you know, Arabs in the Sudan. But they are indigenous to the Sudan. And many of them now have come to accept the fact that, you know, they are Arabs. But in fact, those are people of African origin. They look like Ethiopians, if you know what I mean by complexion. Those are Nubians. But further south, to the west, in the western Sudan, in the southern Kordofan, live another group of people. Historically, they have some connections with the Nubians of the north. And those areas, the southern Sudan, and the Nuba Mountains, and parts of eastern, the southern Blue Nile, these people were closed off because the British argued that because these people were different, were less enlightened, that they would fall easy prey to the more enlightened, rapacious or whatever group from the north, the Islamic group. So they were shut off. So that by the time of independence, in fact, well, just before independence, a few years before independence, the south and the north were administered separately. The two parts of the country were administered separately. And before then, there were various groups in the southern Sudan that live, you know, the largest, of course, are the Dinka. I don't know whether you have heard the name Dinka. Those of you who have read anthropology, these names that should be familiar to you. Nuer, they are Zande people. This is the, with the A here, that's the plural form. Bari. Shulu, those of you who have read, Fraser, you know, the study of the, what do you call it, societies with divine kings, the Shulu Baraman books, and many other groups in the southern Sudan. This, you know, led discrete, separate lives. Each community was self-contained. There was no sense of a southern Sudan as an imagined community. They were administered separately, although they interacted minimally. Each group regarded itself as being separate from any other group in the southern Sudan, unlike the north. Because in the north there was Islam there and so on. So that is the, that's the country in which we are trying to decide find a definition of some of the events, whether there was whether there's genocide in the Sudan or not. And I'll give you the key events. Let me start with 55. Yes, a few months before the Sudan became an independent United Republic, there was, because of the history of the relations between the people of the Southern Sudan and the North, there were army garrisons in the Southern Sudan which were predominantly non-Arab, officered by, non-Arab as I've indicated, defined, by self-definition. The officer corps, before the British left the country, was predominantly British. But after the British left, the officers commanding troops of the Sudan Defense Forces, it used to be called SDF. Based in the southern part of the country, in a place called Tawrid, number 2 company, it was a very small camp. The British managed to administer for over 60 years a country, maybe 10 times the whole of Western Europe, with a minimal force. A few British commanding officers and a mass of black troops, paid minimum wages, used the local population to control their own, or control the whole country. You didn't have to station British troops in the Sudan, no. They used the local askari, that's the Arabic word for the soldier, the local askari, the local soldier, control a huge area like the Sudan or a whole continent. So troops in this fearing domination from the Northern Sudan rebelled and killed the Northern Sudanese officers. And then it spread in one province. At that time there were three, the South was divided into three provinces. But it was only in one part where Tawrid is that the rebellion took place. And it spread to other towns of Equatoria, the place called Equatoria. Back to other parts of Equatorial Province, bordering Uganda and Congo. It spread, so wherever there were Northern Sudanese civilians, traders, innocent traders, these were all killed. And in all, by the time it was all over in this particular area of the Southern Sudan, the Equatorial Province, over 300 Northern Sudanese were killed, simply because they were Northern Sudanese. They spoke Arabic, they spoke Islam, but it was mayhem. Anyhow, because the British Governor General and his civil secretary, the executive director, in fact, the man who did the day-to-day running of the administration, was still present, still had power over the country. And because the South, wrongly in my view, had faith, more faith in the justice of the British administration They allowed themselves to be talked into surrendering, and then more troops were brought in from the northern Sudan. And instead of confining themselves to dealing with the rebellion in this one province, the high-handedness, in fact, helped spread it to the other provinces of the southern Sudan, the other two, Bahr Ghazal, predominantly inhabited by the Dinka, and Upper Nile province, inhabited by the Shuluk, the Nuer and the Shuluk. So that because of the high-handedness, the bad management of the then national government, which was poised to take over the independent Sudan, mistakes were made which actually helped it spread to the rest of the Sudan, of the southern Sudan, so that we ended up with a situation where the conflict became a north-south thing. See what I mean? Instead of, dealing with, which they call mutiny, in Arabic, they call that tamarut. Tamarut in Arabic, when you mutiny, it's not only a rebellion against a system run by people. It's also rebellion against Islam, against religion, against God. Tamarut in this context. So that in this war, no prisoners are taken on the government side. They don't take prisoners. They don't keep prisoners. You execute them somewhere, because somehow you give yourself the right, a God-ordained right, to deal in a summary fashion with people who are not only rebelling against the duly constituted government of the country, but they are also rebelling against God. Because the government represents the power of Islam in this context. I don't know how it works in other countries, Islamic countries, but this is the context in this country. So because of mistakes made, the government came, sent in reinforcements. They overhauled the whole administrative system, the whole educational system, and so on in the country, so that the southerners found themselves feeling as if, in fact, they now had a new master who was passing as their brothers. They called them, they called themselves our northern brothers. But it appeared to a lot of southerners that, in fact, this was the so-called independence was becoming a change of masters. From English-speaking masters, masters who spoke some European language. Now we were having new masters who spoke Arabic, who were Muslim, and were now seeking us, just as the European missionaries had done. Were now seeking to transform us into Arabs, convert us to Islam. As the missionaries have tried to make us Europeans and convert us to Christianity, so that you had an appearance of simple substitution of masters. So on both sides, that's the first phase of the war. It became a north-south thing, and language terms are used loosely. The Arabs. And of course, it fitted in with the normal division in Islam of the world into Dar Harb, a land of war, and Dar Islam, land of peace, which of course is the land of Islam. So the conflict took that turn, and so again leading to some of the events which I shall. So, the first phase of the war lasted to 72. until 72. Now the second phase, in that first phase, the South has three regional capitals. There's a place called Juba, very close to Uganda. There's Malacca. This was the provincial capital of the southern Sudan at the time, during the first phase of the war. Then a place called Wau. And many other towns there. During that phase, in 1965, you know, as I say, the mutiny or the rebellion that started in 1955 in that place, Torit, took the form, continued after the high-handedness with which the government in Khartoum came and tried to deal with the situation in the South. Some of the elements of the forces that had rebelled in Torit in August 55 took to the forest and began organizing guerrilla warfare. And you know what happens in a civil war situation, in a guerrilla warfare situation. The government had to try and devise ways of dealing with what they call mutiny or rebellion in the southern Sudan. And in doing so, again, showed ineptness in the handling of a very sensitive situation, to the extent that you became a rebel simply by ethnic origin. If you are a southerner with some education, you were seen as either a rebel or a potential rebel. And that definition encompassed even those who were working in government institutions like school teachers, public administrators, veterinarians, medical doctors, you name it. If you were a southerner, you had a Christian name, you were missionary educated, that actually put you, beyond the pale from the point of view of those who had to try and deal with the situation in the Sudan. So in 1965, there were events which, at the very least, one can only describe as massacres. In this place, 75, in July, 1965, 75 senior government officials, including women and children who were at a wedding party, were shot down. They were killed. You know, they were found in one place and shot down. And then from there, the government went from village, from town to town, killing any group of they found any group of educated southerners, they just killed them. They were rebels. And the official media, of course, say that all those people who were killed were rebels. This was in July 8th. On July 9th, Juba, the capital of Equatoria, the army just ran amok. Just one night's work. 800 people. No, 1,000 people were killed. Houses burned down in this town, not in the forest where the guerrilla fighters were. And that may have continued to killing, the looting, the burning in every southern Sudanese town and village where anybody who looked educated was found. By the end of the first phase of the war, half a million Southerners that died either to war or war-related consequences. And many of, very few, maybe not even 1,000 of the guerrilla fighters could be counted among the half million in the 17-year first phase of the war. The second phase now is even more deadly. The estimates are that 500,000 Southern Sudanese live in exile in foreign countries as refugees. 4 million of them are displaced in the northern Sudan, mostly in the national capital, but on the outskirts. 4 million people displaced, internal refugees. 4 million people. Over 2 million killed. In 1 month alone in 250,000 in this area where Wau is called Bahre Tau were allowed. I mean, this is a war where you don't keep prisoners, where you use any method, including denying food, including using food, creating famine as an instrument of war. A quarter of a million people were allowed to starve to death. International organizations by the then civilian government of the Sudan were not allowed to take in relief or food relief supplies. Within 4 weeks, a quarter of a million people died. Now, as we speak, over 2 billion people have died, either through famine, war-related causes, disease. Over 2 million Southern Sudanese have died. And the international community is either indifferent or doesn't know anything that is happening there or does not want to know. And on good authority, this is, from Jimmy Carter, because he has been to the area many times. The kind of violence and suffering and devastation that has happened is happening in the Sudan. The casualties that in Rwanda, in Bosnia, in Kosovo, in Somalia, all combined, according to Jimmy Carter, in a report he wrote a couple of years ago on returning from the Sudan. Yet, where's the international community? Of course, every single life is one that is lost, is one too many. And yesterday, I think, in one of the panels, we were talking about the motives that take the so-called international community to certain places of the world and not to others. You know, you see the relationship. someone, I think one of the speakers suggested that Afghanistan is important, not because it is Afghanistan or because the people of Afghanistan look prettier than the people of the Southern Sudan. There's oil all around Afghanistan. There's oil there. The so-called, and the international community is defined, also self-defined, arbitrarily self-defined. If America says so, Britain says so, France says so, Canada will follow the definition. You know, we usually follow the definition. France says so, Russia says so, and maybe China, then it is the civilized international community. You know. So the international community was able to intervene in Kosovo, where there were horrors, but of a lesser degree than anything that you can encounter in the Southern Sudan. They were able to go to Yugoslavia, not because the Bosnians look prettier than anybody else. You know? And for those of you who know your European history, the 19th century, there's always been a struggle there. There's Russia, the Russia-Europe confrontation, Russia seeking the warmer waters for its. We are not told that. The media doesn't tell us that. No, those Bosnian Muslims, we love them. We're going to save them. But the Dandelion and the waters into the Mediterranean have always been, you know. And Russia is now a partner. Russia is not aware that it's being encircled, you know, contained. Even after the Cold War. The Southern Sudan now is drawing some more attention because, like Afghanistan, it has oil now and other mineral resources it has. So Canada is there. You won't read all these things that I've been telling you in the media. You won't. You know, there have been a few documentaries on TBC and that thing. But given the interests that are involved with various corporations like Talisman, the Canadian media is not telling us what is happening there. There's no Christian Amanpour broadcasting from Juba or from anywhere. She has not been there, she has been to Somalia. And Somalia, by the way, is, again, these are all strategic places that at the mouth of the, you know, the southern entry into the Red Sea and into the Suez Canal. Yemen, you know, and of course the Gulf states with the oil and so on. So Christina is there, very objective reporter. You know, she's there, and as are many other Western correspondents, but they're not there because of love of human freedom and so on. You know, they represent certain interest groups. You know, they were the corporate media whose interests are being served. You know, when Canada sends its soldiers there, out there, Boston, Kosovo, and so on. That interest being served. And until somehow there's another rival group. I had a map. Almost two-thirds of the Southern Sudan is oil, sitting on oil, including my own hometown. And when we're talking about the politics of oil yesterday, you know, oil is a resource for many of the people in whose areas this mineral oil field is found. It's a curse because they don't benefit from it. The environment, the ecosystem is destroyed. And when the oil exploration takes place there, they are not even consulted. They are not on the boards of anything, corporate boards or anything. Their environment is destroyed, and the Southern Sudan is cattle country. The place is teeming because the livelihood of people depends on their animals, not their cattle. And you destroy these areas, the grazing areas along the Nile where most of the oil is found, without compensation. You know. So there's certainly a reluctance to give the, because the word genocide has a very definite international definition. After the Holocaust, nations of the world agreed that they will not allow any other acts of genocide to occur in any other part of the world without international intervention. But the Americans don't want to send out our boys. You know, they say boys, although there are women there. You know, they're not sending their boys, you know, to those areas. And one way, and yet, this is the country that claims, monopoly on moral superiority. They won't go there, so there's a dodge. They say, no, what is happening there? The slavery? No, there's no slavery. It's abduction. It's abduction, mutually engaged in by the two warring parties, which is nonsense. There are no Northern Sudanese slaves, not one, in the Southern Sudan. So, the way they deal with it, the indifference of the international community is not only as a result of ignorance, but willful unwillingness to accept to call what all the events that are described here as genocide or slavery, because they would have to be compelled by international law, to which they are all signatories, to intervene, and they don't want to send American boys there or Canadian boys there. They don't want it. So the people are told, there's no genocide there. There's no genocide there. But as I've indicated, when you target specific groups, whether they're carrying arms, whether they're engaged in any acts of rebellion, of violence or not, you go to a particular area whose population is composed of a particular ethnic group. I don't know what you call it. What would you call it? You find 75,000 plus their children and women at a wedding party and you shoot them down. There's not a single weapon. You go to a place like Juba, one night's work, you kill 1,000 people. The national capital in 1964, I was there, December 6, 1964. I was an undergraduate at the University of Baltimore. Over, in just one night, mayhem in the national capital, from township to township, over 8,000 Southern Sudanese were killed in their own national capital. The police did nothing. By international definition, that is, when you target a specific group like the Holocaust, you go after the Jewish people simply because they are Jewish. What do you call that? So the way you escape, because you don't want to put your young people at risk in foreign countries. You dodge the issue by changing your language. arbitrarily. Again, that is something we dealt with yesterday, both in the McGill, session and in our panel discussion yesterday. Language here, the corruption of language, as George Orwell wanted to show, the corruption of language. If your language is fuzzy, your moral stance and whatever other stance, political, is likely to be also fuzzy and confused. Yeah. Words are a powerful tool. So you say abduction, not slavery, or massacres, you know, crimes against humanity. If you accept those immoral, morally you are obliged to do something about it. But if you just gain them, you know, then you don't have to do anything because they are not terrible and serious. Or the favorite word of the corporate world in the industrialized country, globalization. But globalization does not mean that you allow, you know, free movement of capital, not just capital, and of profits, but the free movement of all, I mean that in its real definition, the free movement of all factors of production. In economics 101, I think, is there are four of them, or is it five? Labor is one of them. Labor is one of those factors of production. We should have free movement. And yet what we have seen, of course, are restrictions. You know, this is not my topic, but it's related. It's how we escape from responsibilities. You know, we don't say there's genocide in Israel. No. There's a civil war there. There's no genocide. Because to say genocide, we are morally bound to do something about it. After the Holocaust, we say, no, not again, ever. You know. So we. Globalization, but redefined, narrowly defined to suit a particular interest. Genocide to suit where morality happens to fit where our morality tends to fit our interests. They go together. They converge. Then we act. Selective morality. This is what it's all about. And when we say, when I say genocide, is there genocide in Sudan? It's not necessarily coming from the north, the Islamic Arabic speaking north, from there. There are groups within the south, you know, like these people here, they know are going against the Dinka. You slaughter the Dinka, you know. Both parties carrying arms are involved in this. And in Sudanese academic and political circles, it's become the fashion now to say, that's why I went back to 55, 65, and then from 83 to now. Now you are being told it is the problem is the fundamentalist Islamic regime in the Sudan. I say no. The Sudan has set parliamentary systems of government with, you know, as far as the South was concerned, it's been the same. Most of my life, I lived under a state of emergency, in war conditions in the Southern Sudan. From before independence. The South has never had, a situation where there was no state of war, no state of emergency. So where we were educationally, for example, or developed economically, developmentally, where we were in 19, we are behind where we were in 1955, just before independence, educationally. Millions of our children are not going to school. Our cultures are destroyed, the ecosystem, and when you define genocide, you also have to factor in things like the destruction of the environment. Where is the international environmental movement? Where is it? The destruction of the ecosystem. And when you talk about, as Canadians, we talk about talisman role in the destruction of life, where are the environmentalists? To look at what the talisman's presence in the Southern Sudan is doing to the local environmental and ecological system. So is this problem in the Sudan is not just the Islamic government. They've been in power now for about 13 years. Sudan has been independent for about 46 years now. 13 years. What about the other governments before that? They were engaged in the same process of changing the identity of our whole people. Islamic civilizational, Arab civilizational project. And the target here of this project is not just the Southern Sudan. What is happening in the Sudan is that a lot of Muslim people feel that there was an unfinished business. Unfinished because the Europeans came from the north and from East Africa. The whole continent would have been Islamic but for these bad Europeans. Christian Europeans. So with independence, people with that kind of that point of view decided that they just resume what they had left off. Islamize the Southern Sudan, go to East and Arabize it, go to East Africa, complete the job there, and it's no accident that in the last 2 decades. Countries like Kenya, Tanzania, have been under pressure from these Islamic groups, and our country happens to be the only country that calls itself Arab, purely on the basis that the people speak Arabic, and that they are Muslims. The people of Pakistan and India, there are more Muslims in Pakistan than in Pakistan and in India and in Indonesia than there are in the whole so-called Arab-speaking Middle East. But they don't call themselves Arabs. There are more Muslims in Nigeria and Senegal and so on. So there's an injection of racist element there, element of racism. And in the case of the Sudan, the Arabism really springs from a sense of insecurity. Because many of them look like me, yet they are Arabs. And when you are at the periphery, Professor Adi Mazrui has described the Sudan as triple marginalization. not in the mainstream of Arab thought, of Arab culture, of Arab politics. They are not in the mainstream of African culture, of African political culture. And when you are teasing at the age, the likelihood is that you one tends to take more extreme positions than those who are secure. So the Arabism of the Sudan is actually driven by this feeling of insecurity. They have to sound more Arab than they actually are, than the real Arabs, and so on. And there are many manifestations of that. I think I better stop at this point and then ask you for comments, discussion, questions, whatever.
Hi.